We're doing Parshat Matot, and this week it's Matot Masei. It's interesting that Matot Masei are really Parshiot that conclude the Torah, in a sense. The book of Dvarim is a different book, and it's interesting to note that the Torah begins with Shiduchim, and ends with Shiduchim. It begins with the Shidduch of Adam and Eve, and ends with the Shidduchim of the daughters of Tzlafchad. And so in that vein, let's dedicate our learning tonight to all those people searching for Shiduchim. Hashem should bless Liora Bateida and Adam Shmuel ben Bluma Ita and Avram David Shmuel ben Leah and all the other people who are looking for Shiduchim. Well, who? David ben Miriam and Pnina bat Rachel. Let's begin. Yeah. Nava bat Ahuva should have a refuah shleima. Yeah. Right, Nava
Bat Ahuva
Liba Meryl should have a refuah shleima. We all owe our learning to that woman. You guys know who she is. That's who we just said. Okay, Parshat Matot, let's begin. So, in our parsha, we begin with the laws of vows. When a person takes a vow, he must abide by his vow. A husband and a wife, a father and a young daughter, the parent or the spouse, the husband, on the day that they hear the vow, can annul the vow from that moment onward. It is considered a big sin to take a vow, unless it's a time of immense danger. A person is not supposed to take a vow, even if he's going to fulfill the vow. We do have the capacity in certain instances that a rabbi, together with a court, can annul a vow retroactively. A husband and a parent only can annul the vow from the moment they hear it onward, if they protest within that day. That brings us to Sheni, where God tells Moshe, take revenge from the Midianites, and then you will pass away. Moshe is quick to do the task, even though he knows that right afterwards he's going to die. He sends Pinchas and the trumpets and the holy vessels to war, and their intent is to go out and ambush, you know, attack, hurt the Midianites, and God has a different plan. They conquer all of Midian. That wasn't on the agenda. And in the war, they kill Bilam, the son of Beor, Bilam who was also there. They capture the women and the children and the cattle, and they bring it all back. And Moshe says, wait a second, this was a revenge tactic. You guys were taking revenge because of what the women did. How could you bring those same women back into the camp? So Moshe gets upset at them. That's a mistake. You're never supposed to get upset. So the women, who they weren't coming because they had any great desire to be promiscuous with Jewish men, they came with the sole intent, let's cause Jewish men to sin. The shame, can't say the shame shemayim, but you know, for the sake of sin. And that's why God says, those women die. Those women cannot remain around. They caused 24,000 Jews to die. And then we have the laws of how a vessel can absorb the flavor of foods that are cooked in it. And so the vessels that were captured from the Midianites have to undergo a purification process. Anytime you have a non-kosher vessel or a vessel that's purchased from someone who eats non-kosher, so we have to get the flavors out of the walls of the vessel. If the vessel is used, you know, you boil it on the fire, so you have to boil it with water. We always wait a 24-hour period before we kosher a vessel. Another way to cleanse a vessel is, after it's perfectly clean, we get it red hot, and then we burn out the flavor from the walls of the vessel. And we have in the parsha the mitzvah of immersing a vessel, the laws of tevilas kelim. When a vessel is purchased from a non-Jew to a Jew, if that vessel is made of a metal or midrabanon, rabbinically, if that vessel is made of glass, then that vessel should be immersed in a mikveh before it starts being used by a Jew, provided that that vessel comes in direct contact with finishing food products. That brings us to Revi. We take an accounting of the loot, and then there's a tax that's given off of the loot. And then at the end of the parasha, we have a story of the tribe of Reuben and Gad, who have tremendous amounts of cattle, and they say, we want to take this portion of land on the eastern side of the Jordan. It's good for our cattle. And Moshe says, what are you guys thinking? You're not going to join the war to conquer Israel? They say, of course we'll join the war to conquer Israel. So Moshe says, fine, we'll make a deal. If you guys go in and help conquer the land of Israel, then you could have this land on the eastern side of the Jordan. Obviously, God agreed. They take an accounting of the land, and the two tribes came. can't have all the land. They don't have enough people. So Moshe says, who wants to join? And two families of the tribe of Menashe join. And so we have what we call half the tribe of Menashe. It wasn't really half. It was two out of eight families that joined Reuven and Gad on the eastern side of the Jordan. Which brings us to Parshas Maaseh, where we have a recounting of the journeys of the people of Israel en route in the desert. And then we reach our final camp, and God tells Moshe, tell the Jewish people, if you want this land to really be yours, you're about to enter the land of Israel, if you really want it to remain in Jewish hands, if you want to have land to give over to your children, you have to understand that you have to abide by the laws, you have to ensure that you do things the way I told you. You tell the nations of the land of Israel, if you want to accept the Noahide laws, fine, you want to leave, fine, but if you remain, we're not leaving a soul alive. You have one of three options. And you have to stick to that, because if they remain as pagans in the land of Israel, you will not give over the land to your children. There will not be future generations, because there's no way you're going to stand up to the temptation of having people in your midst that are pagans. Pretty scary thought. God says, there's no way you're going to stand up to that temptation. It will not go on for long. And we know we didn't live up to this. Exactly what the Torah warns. That's exactly what happened. God tells us when we come to the land of Israel, these are the boundaries of the land of Israel. So in our parsha, we have the borders of the land of Israel. And then we have instructions who are the leaders who will help us in partitioning the land and dividing it among the tribes. And at the end of the parsha, when we hit Chamishi, we have the mitzvah of cities of refuge. If a person kills someone by mistake, he has to run to one of these six cities of refuge. And aside from the six cities of refuge, we also have 42 Levite cities, which also acted as cities of refuge. You had three cities of refuge on the eastern side of the Jordan, three cities of refuge in Israel. You had another 42 cities of refuge that were Levite cities, three on the eastern side of the Jordan, and another 36 inside Israel. So all these cities are cities where a person who killed by mistake can run over there, and then you can't touch him. And the Torah says this only works if the guy is found that he killed by mistake. If it was in true error, so he could remain in that city until the Kohen Gadol dies. When the Kohen Gadol dies, he's free to go home and his punishment is over. But if a person murdered on purpose, we don't accept any redemption. God warns us, don't accept redemption because that will defile the land. A murderer must be executed. At the end of the parasha, we have the story that the families of Menashe, one of the families that agreed to live outside Israel, on the eastern side of the Jordan, they came with a complaint and they said, you know, there's the daughters of Tzlafchad that were entitled the lot of their father. If they marry outside the tribe, so then their portion of the land is going to be given to other tribes because their children, well, they go after the father. So God says, okay, this generation that's conquering the land of Israel, in order that people will be encouraged to fight and really conquer all of the land of Israel, so this generation may not marry outside the tribe. This generation specifically. And we celebrate the day that that decree was over, the 15th of Av, is a day of Shiduchim, right? The Jewish Valentine's Day. The 15th of Av was a celebration that this decree was over, that we could marry into other tribes. And at the end of the parasha, we hear about how the daughters of Tzlafchad married their cousins. Look at that. For 40 years, they're in the desert, and the shidduch doesn't come up. After 40 years, they're about to enter the land of Israel. Until now, they could have married anyone, and God says, no, now you should marry within your tribe. So then they end up marrying the very cousins they grew up with. Okay. So they marry them, and the Torah concludes the book of Bamidbar. These are the mitzvahs that God commanded in the hands of Moshe and Arvo Smov by the Jordan, that's by Jericho. Okay, so now let's review the parasha with more depth. It's the opportunity of a lifetime. You can become rich and have wealth for you and your kids. And it's at no cost, you know. You could just walk up there and you are going to be so rich. There's only one price tag to the well. It's called Chutz Laretz. But everything else is insured. That's what Reuven and Gad were facing. They had a territory that was as big as all of the land of Israel. Right? You look at the map, it's almost the same size. And if they'd leave it, well then someone else would take the land. It was there free for the taking. We had just conquered all that land. And they had the cattle. They could use the land. And it would be theirs for generations to come. That's it. If they let go, no, it's going to sit out there. Someone else will take it. But if they take it, so then they got huge territory. You see, it was so big that they couldn't even handle all of it. You had to add part of the tribe of Manasseh with them. What happened because they took that territory on the eastern side of the Jordan? So they were very wealthy. They were. Chazal tell us that the way in which they approached the request, the way in which they approached Moshe, gives us an indication that something was wrong. They came to Moshe and said, we have a lot of cattle. We want to build pens for our cattle. And we'll also build cities for our families. And Moshe says, you guys got it all wrong. You're talking about your money before you talk about your families? What's going on here? And the truth is that if we look down the course of history, this decision that they made was all about money. Their thoughts were not about what's best for my family. Because just let's walk 3 months down the road. Okay, 3 months later, all of the tribe of Reuben and Gad, they leave their children to be brought up with their wives for 14 years. Who leaves their family for 14 years? So they mourned it. The Midrash says the men would grow their hair long and their beards long and they wouldn't take a haircut for 14 years. You know, you're talking about some, I don't know, it's pretty scraggly to me, but they were all mourning the fact that they didn't have their kids, and their kids back in on the eastern side of the Jordan, they grew their hair long, they wouldn't take haircuts, they grew their beards long. Everyone was mourning that they weren't together. Very nice, but they weren't together. You have a whole generation that's not being brought up by their father. Let's go further down the road. They come back at the end of the 14 years, so they make this huge altar. And that the tribes of Israel hear that they made this huge altar, they send their soldiers and they say, what's wrong with you guys? Don't you know? God is one God. God is our God. You guys can't be pagans just because you're on the other side of the Jordan. And they say, no. It's quite the contrary. We set this whole thing up so that our kids will know that they're part of Israel. They shouldn't think that they have a separate God. Quite the contrary. We made this whole big thing so that our kids will always know that they're a part of Israel. You're concerned? Your kids are going to grow up not realizing they're a part of Israel? Why didn't you think about that 14 years ago? Or maybe you did, but that wasn't the prime concern. Let's go down the road a few hundred years. What happens with Reuben and Gad? They're the first to be exiled. They're banished. They're lost. So they put their money before their kids, and that's what they got. They got their money, and not their kids. The future generations paid the ultimate price. According to one opinion in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, there's almost nothing left. There were individuals, you know, tens of people that made it out of Reuben and Gad. But that's it. The rest were exiled, either killed or intermarried. It's over. We don't know. It's a machlokas in the end of Sanhedrin. Whether we got some of them back, we didn't get. We know that we have some of each tribe, so some people made it out. But we don't know the numbers. Correct, because there was a natural divide between the two tribes and the rest of Israel, so they were more easily conquered. And you don't even have to go so far as their ultimate exile. You could just go down 100, 150 years later during the period of the judges, you see that they were constantly being attacked by the enemies. So they figured, we have a strong army, right? There's a sign, someone has a car parked in front of the yeshiva and he has a bumper sticker, I saw it on my way in. Israel is stronger than it's ever been before. Really? Okay. That's interesting. You guys know that Iran deployed certain certain equipment in Syria so that they could tell every plane that takes off from here so they could know if we're coming to attack them. Today, now, they have this equipment in Syria. Stronger than ever, right? So even if we are today, we have to take things in the perspective of thousands of years. That's how Israel lives. We don't think in terms of today and tomorrow. That's one of the big errors when they talk about giving away land. That they keep thinking about today and tomorrow. Today we can handle giving this much land away. I'm not even talking from a religious perspective. From a military perspective. Who told you what where weaponry is going to be developed tomorrow. Well, yeah, that's a calculation. Today we could handle it. So Reuven and Gad, they made a fatal error. A fatal error literally, spiritually. But the truth is that each of us has this temptation in our own lives. I think that often in life we have offers, temptations. Chutz La'aretz is an attractive thing. And they had it bigger than any of us do. The land was just there for the taking. You're talking about a huge piece of land, and they did have the cattle. Where'd they have all this cattle from? How'd they get so rich?
They inherited from the Midianites.
From the Midianites, right. So, for whatever reason, the tribe of Reuven and Gad got very rich from this campaign against the Midianites. And often in life, when our financial situation shifts drastically in a short amount of time, so then people can make very big mistakes. It's not the time to make decisions. Most lottery winners are miserable. There's a huge percentage that commit suicide. You guys could go online, do a search, you'll see. Moshe tells us the laws of vows. What is the concept of vows? So we have the concept of korbanos. You have a sheep. You could designate this sheep is going to be a sacrifice. With the words you've said, you've imparted holiness on that sheep. Now that sheep is designated with the holiness of being sacrificed shlamim, sacrifice ola, whatever sacrifice you're going to bring. Tells us the Torah, you could take your cup of coffee and say, this cup of coffee is going to be upon me like a korban. I am hereby saying this should be forbidden upon me, just like a sacrifice would be forbidden upon me. That is the concept of a neder. A neder is that we take the holiness of korbanos, we take the holiness of kachin, and we say, this thing is hereby prohibited upon me as though it were something holy, as though it were a korban. So far, so good. Then we come to the concept of shvua. What's a shvua? Shvua is a vow. A person says, I promise I will eat a hamburger today. That's a shvua. So there's neder and there's shvua. We're not supposed to say nedarim or shvua. It's not a proper thing to do. And even if we're going to fulfill it, it's considered a sin. So we have the laws that a husband can annul his wife's vows, a father can annul his daughter's vows. What happens if they take a vow and then the time passes where they can annul it? Or the parent or the spouse said, yeah, that's a good vow, you stick to that, honey. And then 10 minutes later they say, actually, I want to annul it. They can't. And if they tell her, okay, I hereby annul it, and then the wife or the daughter transgresses the vow because she thinks, you know, my spouse or my parent annulled it, so then it's the spouse's fault, it's the parent's fault, they misled them. And the Torah says they need forgiveness. What happens if the spouse annuls the vow, but the wife didn't know that? The wife takes on a vow, she says, I will not shower the whole 3 weeks and the whole month of Av. And the husband hears that, so it's a vow that pertains to the husband a little bit, assuming he's in town, right? So the husband can annul it. It pertains to him. So he says, really? He walks to the other room and he says, I'm annulling that vow. That vow should be annulled. But he doesn't tell her. He says, you know, I'm going to teach her a lesson. She shouldn't talk that way. Fine. He doesn't tell her. He annulled the vow. 3 days later, the neighbors start telling them, you guys must have something rotten in your house. You know, there's a stench coming from your house, guys. So she's feeling a little uncomfortable. All the perfumes can't cover up what nature does. So she looks to her right, looks to her left. No one's home. She goes and takes a shower. Technically, did she sin? No. Her vow was annulled from the minute her husband annulled it, from that minute onward. Did she know that? No. She thought she was doing a sin. Tells us the Torah, Hashem will forgive her. She has to do tshuva for that, and Hashem will forgive her. And Chazal tell us from here, we learn an important concept. If a person thinks what he's doing is wrong, then the fact that it turns out that it's right doesn't rectify the situation completely. If I came in here and I thought that steak was non-kosher meat, and then I sat down and ate it, the fact that afterwards it turns out that it was kosher, that doesn't fix the situation completely. There's still an aspect that one must do tshuva, and that's a biblical concept here in the Torah. What happens in situations of doubt? You know, that's the toughest situation. you come home and there's delicious steak and you tell yourself, well, my parents know I eat kosher, so it's probably a kosher piece of meat here. They wouldn't leave this here if they knew I was coming home, right? So you're standing there, you're famished. It's Matzah Tisha B'Av. You're just after the fast. So, okay, we don't eat meat Matzah the fast anyways. But okay, for whatever reason, you're very hungry. You just came back from the army. And you're standing there by the fridge and you're looking. And you're saying yes or no or yes or no. And then you eat it. And your parents come home and you say, was that kosher meat? And they say, yeah, 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 of course, come on, we knew you were coming home. That doesn't mean everything's okay. Meaning when a person acted, did he know it was mutar or not? If we didn't know it was mutar, so then we put ourselves in a situation where we risked doing an avera. The fact that afterwards it turns out it wasn't an avera doesn't rectify the situation completely. So I ate kosher, I'm okay. But I'm not completely okay because God knows that I was willing to eat non-kosher that moment, right? God knows. And that's this concept that Hashem says, I will forgive you for something like that, but you have to request forgiveness. You have to do tshuva. I'm willing to forgive, but you have to realize that there's a repentance that has to happen here. You can't just say, well, everything worked out okay. People sometimes do this, you know. They speed through red light. And then everything's okay. But no, everything's not okay. You risk killing someone. The fact that no one happened to die that time, okay, you still have an accounting with God. The same thing, people don't buckle seatbelts. Why aren't you buckling a seatbelt? Everything's okay. No, everything's not okay. You took a risk. You were willing to risk harming someone, even yourself. And God says, that's not okay with me. You want something? Yes. So neder can also encompass other examples that are slightly different, but for that we need more time. But what I said is the classical case of neder. You're right that there can be instances where it will encompass a little bit more. For example, if a person takes upon himself to do something positive three times, a person goes to dafyomi 3 days straight, he takes upon himself, he does an action that indicates that he will do something positive. So doing something positive three times can also be a form of a vow. But okay, there's a whole tractate called Nedarim and a whole tractate called Shavuos. And there's a whole 7 minutes left to class. So let's move forward. That's a good question. I don't know. We try to annul all our vows on Erev Yom Kippur, we say all our vows should be annulled this year too, and we try not to take vows. Yes?
I have a question that's not related, there's only 7 minutes left. So.
Yeah, so let's hold off. Okay. We'll talk after class. Let's move forward. Moshe Rabbeinu hears he has a mitzvah, and after he goes to war against Midian, he's going to die. So there's a big temptation there, you know. Let's just hold off on this war. And that's what the Jewish people want to do. When Moshe says it's time to go, we got to do this war and then I'm going to die. So Jewish people say, we're not going. And Moshe tells them, no, 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 you guys got to go. This is what God wants. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. Chazal tell us in contradistinction that when Yeshua heard that after he divides up the land of Israel, he's going to die. So Yeshua put off dividing the land of Israel, and he lost numerous years from his life. Meaning, we don't know God's factors, the way God does his mathematics. In life, we have to know. We have to do our job and let God run the show. At the end of the day, if God tells us to do something, we got to do it, and that's what Moshe does. They come back from war, and Moshe goes out to greet them. We see the modesty, the humility of Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe Rabbeinu walks out to greet them. They should all be coming to him, but they're all his students, but that doesn't interest him. He goes out to greet them. He sends Pinchas along with them because of the concept that when you derive benefit from a place, you shouldn't be the one to hurt that place. And being that Moshe Rabbeinu grew up in Midian, he does not want to be the one leading the war against the Midianites. That's his home territory. He grew up there in Midian. So he sends Pinchas. Pinchas is the one that started the revenge against the Midianites. We have a concept, HaMatchil b'mitzvah, Omrim lo gmor. He who begins a mitzvah, we encourage him to complete the mitzvah. He who begins a mitzvah and does not complete the mitzvah, so we have on tradition that that's a curse in heaven that one should bury one's wife and children. God in heaven says, you didn't finish, you have unfinished business, so to speak, so God continues the unfinished business. Finished business is a wife and children, a continuum. Unfinished business, God, we learn that from Yehuda, who started saving Yosef, but stopped midway. He could have saved Yosef, but he didn't. He said, let's not kill him. Ah, but we'll sell him. Ah, but we'll sell him. That's why he lost his wife and his children. So Pinchas, who started the mitzvah of dealing with the Midianites, he concludes the mitzvah. They killed Bilam because Bilam is the root of the problem here. Bilam is the one that advised them to go and be promiscuous with Israel. What was Bilam doing there? Well, Bilam had said, I can't curse them because they're perfect. Look at the Jewish people. Lo hibit aven b'Yaakov. God hasn't seen any sin among Jacob. Bilam is purposely hinting to them, you got to make them sin. I can't curse them because there is no sin among Jacob. So now the Midianites, they send word to Bilam, hey, we did what you hinted to us. Now you won't be able to say that anymore. God has seen no sin among Israel. We've caused them to sin. Come back. Now you could curse them. So Bilam gets on his mule and rides back there. He comes back there and we attack. And Moshe told them, you're going to find Bilam there and kill him. Moshe wanted to see Bilam dead. It was one of the things he asked God to see in his lifetime. We have a Midrash that says Bilam used the different forces that he knew how to access. He took soldiers on flying carpets, and Pinchas took the Aron, and he took the Tzitz, and with that he was able to throw him down. We have a Midrash that says that Pinchas traveled out to that wall where Bilam's leg was bashed, which was the same pile of stones that Bilam's great-great-grandfather Lavan made a pact together with our great-great-grandfather Yaakov that we won't cross that pile of stones to harm one another. And inside the pile of stones they buried a sword, so to speak, to say whoever crosses this pile of stones to hurt the other should be killed by this sword. And so Pinchas took that sword to actually kill Bilam. We have on tradition that when things are spoken, even among simple people, God listens. There was once a girl who was traveling and fell into a well, and the shepherd came to draw her out of the well, and when he was about to draw her out of the well, he said, you're a pretty good looking girl, I'll draw you out of the well if you'll marry me. So she says, what? You want me to marry you now here in the middle of the field? I'm going to die. I'm going to drown. He says, okay. So she says, okay, fine. I'll marry you. I promise you I'll marry you. But let's have a normal Jewish wedding. This is the town I live in. Come and get me. So he draws her out of the water. He says, I promise I'll marry you. She says, I promise I'll marry you. Who are the witnesses? They appoint the weasel. They appoint the pit. There are no people around. These two are the witnesses that we promised one another. We'll marry no one else. She goes back home, gets ready for a wedding, and is waiting for him. She lives in some far out town. He goes back home and forgets her. Picks up another girl and gets married. Gets married and has children. And she's waiting for the guy. They promised one another they'd wait for one another. He has a child number one. Has child number two. Child number one gets eaten by a weasel. Child number two falls into a pit and dies. And his wife tells him, wait a second, what's wrong? This isn't normal. Why are our children dying like this? So he says, I'll tell you the truth. I once met a girl, and I promised her I'd marry her, and we appointed the weasel and the pit. They would be witnesses. So she says, well, okay, so you see, God is holding it against you, so divorce me and go marry her. Whether this story ever happened or not, we don't know. It seems like it did. It's a discussion of Rashi and Tosus and the Aruch and Tanis. But from here, it's an example that people give that God holds us to what we say. Bilam, his great-great-grandfather Lavan, made a pact with Yaakov, and they made a pact that sword is witness. So that sword is what kills him, just like the weasel is what killed the child of that shepherd, because he promised. He said, the weasel is going to be witness against me. We have the story of the loot of the Midianites. There are three major differences between this loot and the loot of previous wars. This time it was a war of revenge. It wasn't a war of conquering the land. this was God's revenge, so that's why we give the taxes to God's men. There are other differences. It's interesting that when God tells Moshe, go take the revenge of the Jewish people, Moshe says to the Jewish people, we will go fight this war and takes God's revenge. The Midrash says, Moshe turned to God and said, what do you mean it's our revenge? It's your revenge. Why did they start up with us? Because we're your chosen people. Why do the nations hate the Jewish people? Because we're your people, God. Don't tell us it's our revenge, it's your revenge. And this Midrash is a fantastic concept. Moshe has a conversation with God and he says, God, you know and I know, if we'd be behaving like the nations, if we wouldn't be your chosen people, no one would hate us. There'd be no anti-Semitism in the world. Anti-Semitism stems from the fact that you chose us. And so when they hate us, it's their way of hating you. It's not our revenge, it's your revenge. Yes?
Father Luke, why did the Levites get the 60,000 young women that were out of age? What was the purpose of that? Because they were specifically not killed because they were not of maturity age. So what's...
You asked many questions, long answers, right? Let's talk about it later. we have the story of Reuben, God, and half the tribe of Menashe. There are two points that we'll end with from that story, and that is. Number one, the way they made the condition, we learn from that how all conditions in halacha should be formulated. Hein kodem lelav, tnai kodem lemaiseh, tnai kafel. We have different laws on how to make conditions in halacha. You have to make it a tnai kafel, like Moshe said to them. If you do this, then this will happen. And if you don't do it, then that will happen. That's called tnai kafel. Two ways in the condition. You say what will happen if yes, what will happen if no. And in the Tanai Kavel, when you double up the condition, you say, Hein kodem lelav. You say, what will happen if you fulfill the condition? And what will happen if you don't? But you begin by saying, by saying what will happen if you do. And Tanai kodem lemaiseh. You say the condition before what will happen. If you do, then this will happen. You don't say, you'll have the land on the eastern side of the Jordan if you come into the land of Israel. That's called maiseh kodem letnai. The result precedes the condition. No, the condition, if you enter and help conquer the land of Israel, the condition precedes the outcome. So we have different laws of tnaim that we learn from here. There's another important concept we learn from here. Moshe tells the tribe of Reuben and Gad, you will join in conquering the land of Israel. V'yitem nekiyim elokim umei Yisrael. You will be clean from God and man. And here we have a concept that appears often in halacha, and that is the concept that you have to look good in the eyes of man, not only the eyes of God. If a woman is pregnant, but no one knows she's pregnant, but because she's pregnant, the doctors tell her she must eat on Tisha B'Av. So she could sit outside and eat her bread and water, and all the neighbors walk by, and she's like smiling to herself, I bet they're wondering why I'm eating on Tisha B'Av. Yes, they're wondering why you're eating on Tisha B'Av. No one sees you're pregnant, no one knows, and no one knows your doctor told you you have to eat. So the Torah tells us, be clean not only with God, but also with man. We have to behave in a way that not only God knows that we're clean, we also have to take into account what are other people thinking. And this is a concept of marisayin. Don't do something that looks bad to other people. And this is a concept we see in our parasha, and it repeats itself throughout Tanakh and throughout the halachos. A guy was walking and he gets caught in a downpour. So the halacha says, don't hang out your clothes to dry outside your porch. Everyone who sees it thinks you just did your laundry on Shabbos. So you know you got caught in the downpour, and that's why you have to hang your clothing to dry. Do it in the bath. Hang it up inside where no one will see it. So there are different laws of marisayin. Sometimes we say, afilu b'chadrei chadorim osur, that's what's prohibited because of marisayin may not be done even inside us in secluded areas. Because we say, once our sages said that something is prohibited because of marisayin, then it's across the board. Even in private, it's prohibited. Things that were not defined by our sages as prohibited because of marisayin, but rather we say, you know, I shouldn't do this because people will think bad things about me. So those things that are not explicitly defined by our sages, there, if you do it in private, then most often it would be permitted. You just have to do it in a place where people won't see. Okay, that's these two parshiyos in a nutshell. Laila Tov.